I have come to the conclusion that I will be supporting ratification of the START Treaty.
Senator Murkowski commits to reducing nuclear weapons. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 21st of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a man missing for 3 days on the tundra is found cold but alive.
He would have been more visible if he had walked out, but I think at that time he was starting to lose energy and, you know, was starting to get weak.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Senator Lisa Murkowski committed today to vote for START, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. The new START over nuclear arms with Russia is one of President Obama's top priorities, and today enough Republicans signaled they will vote yay to reach the needed two-thirds vote of the Senate. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Senator Murkowski was one of 11 Republicans to join with all Democrats Tuesday to vote to end debate on the START Treaty. That clears the path for a final vote on Wednesday.
I have come to the conclusion that I will be supporting ratification of the START Treaty. I was perhaps looking at this treaty perhaps through a more parochial lens from the Alaska perspective.
Murkowski says her concern was about the treaty's impact to missile defense, especially the ground-based system at Fort Greely in Delta Junction. So she reached out to the administration and got calls from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vice President Biden. She also talked to the commander-in-chief.
The president called, it was about a week or so ago, and it was a conversation that was very brief, and all he urged me was to consider the issue on the merits, give it, you know, listen to the experts, and if that was a lobbying call, it was probably it was very benign, let's put it that way.
Murkowski says the clincher was hearing from the head of missile defense, Lieutenant General Patrick O'Reilly, who both talked to her and sent a letter Tuesday morning.
Had good discussions with General O'Reilly yesterday, and then again received this letter this morning that gives me some assurance that the commitment is not only there to the future of Fort Greely and Alaska's role in the National Missile Defense System, but to the broader picture of missile defense as a whole.
The leader of Murkowski's party in the Senate, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, has been fighting against the treaty, citing concerns that the Russians' opinions of missile defense could hamper the U.S. position in the future. He told CNN's Candy Crowley on the show State of the Union Sunday why he's voting no.
An equally important question is, how do the Russians view missile defense, and how do our European allies view missile defense? And I'm concerned about it. I think if they had taken more time with this, rushing it right before Christmas, it strikes me as it's trying to jam us.
But Alaska Senator Mark Begich says the process has not been rushed and that a dozen hearings have been held over months in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. His Committee of Armed Services has pressed the Obama administration on its missile defense plans over the past year, and Begich has liked their responses.
Beginning of last year was on the deathbed. You know, it was over. And so we worked very hard with both Democrats and Republicans on the committee, as well as an independent, you know, Lieberman, Sessions, myself, Senator Levin, and working the language in to ensure that the missile defense system at Fort Greely would continue to operate and expand and get renovated. You know, the administration did not have that in their original budget. And after we laid out, I think, the right language that ensured the flexibility to the missile defense system, that if they decided, depending on what they did in Europe, they could move forward on Fort Greely and it would be okay. And sure enough, here we are today. It is a focal point of this big discussion.
Senator Begich accuses Murkowski's Republican colleagues of playing politics over the treaty.
I think there's some of them that are looking for an excuse for more politics than really getting something done.
Since the Senate got more than the 60 votes needed to cut off debate over START on Tuesday, it can move ahead after weighing in on a series of amendments. Final passage could be Wednesday, giving President Obama a win both at home and abroad before Christmas. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Delta Junction city officials say they don't believe the new START treaty will threaten the missile interceptor base at Fort Greely, but others aren't so sure. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Fort Greely has always served as the main economic engine for the Delta area since the post was established in 1948. When Greely was closed in the late 1990s through the Federal Base Realignment and Closure Process, or BRAC, it devastated the area's economy. Greely reopened in 2001 when the Pentagon decided to build the main component of its national missile defense system there. Since then, the missile interceptor site at Greely has employed hundreds of workers to build it and hundreds more to operate it, mainly contractor personnel. And about 150 Army National Guard members are assigned to operate the facility. Almost all those people live, work, and shop in the area, which injects tens of millions of dollars into the area's economy. And so there's been some concern that the new START treaty might represent a threat to that economic engine. Longtime Delta resident Lou Heinbockel, a city councilman and former mayor, says the experience with Greeley's closure through the BRAC made it obvious that the fort is essential to the area's economy.
Without them bringing missile defense here, there would be no Fort Greely, and there would be very little left of Delta Junction. You know, that's just the reality of the situation.
Heinbockel says he personally was wary about the new START treaty because he doesn't believe it should limit the development of the nation's missile defense system. But he says his personal opinion is that as long as the treaty addresses only the U.S. and Russian stockpiles of strategic nuclear weapons and doesn't threaten missile defense, he's in favor of ratification.
If this new treaty would have both nations, Russia and the United States, get rid of some of this stuff, I'm in favor of it. As long as it doesn't affect our ability to defend ourselves against rogue nations.
Stormy Mitchell, a contractor employee at the missile base, says she and other employees feel uncomfortable about the treaty. She says that's because she and other longtime residents remember the turmoil of the days of Greeley's closure.
I guess the big concern is for us Alaskans is that they don't try to use that as an avenue to take jobs away from us by downsizing the missile defense up here.
Mitchell says the treaty causes her to worry, despite assurances by both of Alaska's senators. She's concerned that the treaty will lead to cutbacks at the missile base, and that will bring back the bad old days of economic hardship to Delta.
You know, they're saying that it's not going to have an impact, but I'm skeptical.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Former legislator, commissioner, and lobbyist Wally Walter Kubley has died at the age of 89. Governor Sean Parnell ordered state flags lowered today in Kubley's memory. Kubley served in the Alaska State House of Representatives during the second and third legislatures. He was a senior advisor and legislative liaison to Governor Wally Hickel and was commerce commissioner under Governor Keith Miller. He also was a longtime lobbyist in the state capitol working on Southeast issues. In later years, his son Don Kubley lobbied with him. He says the Ketchikan shipyard is one of the highlights.
He was one of those old school guys that was doing that way back in territorial days, and being able to work with him and learn from him and his friends is one of my greatest memories.
When Kubley served in the legislature not long after statehood, he helped write the 1963 legislation that established the State Division of Marine Transportation and the Alaska Marine Highway System. Wally Kubley served in the U.S. Coast Guard during World War II. When he returned to Ketchikan, he built the now famous Sourdough Bar, as well as Ketchikan's first bowling alley. He's survived by two sons, a daughter, and six grandchildren. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Eagle River composer warms up a frozen night.
I write old school sometimes, still with staff paper and pencil, and try to get away from cliché.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
A snow machiner missing for 3 days was found by search teams late Monday afternoon. The traveler had just a little food, but an extensive search between the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers came through for him in time. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
Guzma Pitka, age 36, of Bethel, was located by aerial searchers after a full weekend plus another day surviving in the elements.
This man had will to live.
Bethel Search and Rescue President Peter Atchak was at a debriefing of the search. He says Pitka was spotted by a trooper plane with volunteer spotters on board.
One of them spotted him standing kind of against the timberline there where he was, and he would have been more visible if he had walked out. But I think at that time he was starting to lose energy and, you know, was starting to get weak. So he probably, you know, starting was to get out there in the deep snow out to the open, you know, where he could have been more visible.
Pitka was intending to travel by himself from the village of Akachuk on the Kuskokwim River up to the village of Russian Mission on the Yukon River. The trip goes over a vast landscape of tundra and drainages, tree lines, and sloughs. It's remote, and it's left several travelers in dire straits over the years. From the look of Pitka's trail, he had a hard slog. He was transporting a caribou, but had to ditch it along the way after getting bogged down in snow several times.
He did eventually get stuck in Pikmiktaluk, one of those climbs off a river, and there's deep snow on one side.
Atchak says Pitka left his snow machine and gear behind to walk to the tree line. It was about a 5 to 6 mile walk, much of that in deep snow. He stamped SOS in the snow and rested as best he could under the sparse foliage.
He broke down some spruce branches and used them for, you know, sitting down on, laying, resting on, and build a little fire from whatever he could break off underneath those dry branches underneath the trees.
Pitka was found about an hour before the sunset on Monday. He is receiving medical attention, but was reported to be in good health by the Alaska State Troopers. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The U.S. Census Bureau released the first 2010 results today. The figures show that the resident population of the country on April 1st of this year was up by nearly 10% over the 2000 resident population. Hector Maldonado, a partner specialist with the Census Bureau, says for Alaska, the population increase was higher than the national average at 13.3%.
The new population total is 710,000. 231, the resident population count for the state of Alaska.
Has there been any anecdotal evidence from the counters themselves about what the reception may have been like this time in light of this big education effort that preceded the counting? How was the reception in communities during this census compared to the last census?
The general feeling is that the community has been very receptive to the census. I think a lot of efforts were done not only by the Census Bureau in our media campaign, but more importantly and significantly by the state of Alaska. They had a very successful and strong complete count committee headed up by the lieutenant governor and the governor's office. To the very small communities and the villages that you mentioned, they were very, very active in promoting the census. The different hub cities, Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, they were all very active because they wanted an accurate count. So I think when we get the numbers for the state of Alaska at the local level, they will reflect that the efforts that were made there in Alaska.
And the efforts of the lieutenant governor and the committees here in the state and the hub communities, how does that compare to other states? Do most states put out similar efforts, or was it an unusually large effort in Alaska?
Well, I was personally involved with the effort in Alaska, as well with a couple other states in our region. And I can tell you that the efforts in Alaska were definitely, they were very active. Not all states formed committees. In fact, some of the states didn't form a committee. So that really, I think, pointed to the commitment on behalf of the state of Alaska elected officials to make sure that there was an accurate count. The effort was definitely a very strong one.
Hector Maldonado is a Census Bureau partner specialist. More detailed census information about Alaska's population will be released in February. Seventh graders at Floyd Dryden Middle School are learning advanced math and science concepts this year by building underwater remote-operated vehicles. The Sea Perch program trains teachers to build the robots and gives them ideas for classroom use. The first National Sea Perch Challenge will be held in Philadelphia next May. And as KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, some Floyd Dryden students hope to compete.
On your mark, get set. Go!
At the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, Rebecca Farrell signals her students to start their robots. Each kid uses a remote control to maneuver the submersible away from the wall of the pool, through a hula hoop, and back to the wall. Then they hand the remote to a teammate, who repeats the exercise. The Floyd Dryden Middle School teacher organized this friendly competition to try out the bots, which the class has been working on since October.
There's physics involved. There's definitely engineering. Newton's law, push, pull, different kinds of like measurements and Archimedes' principle.
Sea Perch robots come in a kit, which costs about $120. It includes all the stuff needed to make an underwater vehicle: PVC pipe, electrical wire, small plastic propellers, and about 100 other parts. As the students raced their robots through the hula hoops, they had to deal with a variety of problems, ranging from faulty batteries to missing motors.
And you know what? In competition, when this actually happens, you're probably going to be stuck with one motor, so you have to figure that one out.
The kids enjoyed building the robots so much that Farrell hopes to take two teams to the first National Sea Perch Challenge next May in Philadelphia. During the competition, they'll be navigating their robots through an obstacle course and completing a challenge based on the recent Gulf oil spill, where underwater remote vehicles were used to cap the blown-out well.
The simulation is actually just bubbles coming up out of the water, and they have to work as a team to do it, so it's a two-person team, so I want to take two teams with an alternate.
In a field that's traditionally male-dominated, the Floyd Dryden students going to the national competition are all girls. One of the goals of the Sea Perch program is to increase students' interest in math and science. 12-year-old Sophia Kalki says the project has opened her eyes to various career options.
It involves science and math and marine biology and electricity.
Kalki's teammate, Amanda Bicknell, says she's looking forward to the national competition and showing what the Floyd Dryden students have learned.
It's a great opportunity for us to be from Alaska and get to go and to represent our school and our state.
The competition is on the campus of Drexel University. The girls are trying to raise travel expenses and are taking donations of cash and airline miles. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook.
If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
The state of Alaska says it will sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service over protections recently put in place to help polar bears faced with the effects of climate change. Polar bears are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, and more than 187,000 square miles of critical habitat in the Arctic has been designated to help the species recover. The state says the critical habitat includes areas where there is little or no evidence that the areas are crucial to polar bear conservation. On Tuesday, the state put the federal agency on notice that it intends to sue unless the critical habitat designation is changed. If no action is taken in the next 60 days, the state will file a lawsuit. A University of Alaska Fairbanks scientist is being tapped by the state to look at how polar bears have adapted to climate changes historically. The Alaska Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development is providing a $400,000 grant for a study led by Matt Cronin, a UAF animal geneticist based on at the Palmer Experimental Farm. Cronin says the idea is to gain perspective on how the bears may respond to current climate warming.
I told the folks in the state government, I said, you know, I can't assess the future for you. But what I can do is give you good, hard science about polar bears and their history. And that may give us some insights as to how they survive previous warming periods.
Cronin's past research has included work for the oil industry and other partisan funders, but he says he's not concerned about his data being misused to advocate for a particular position.
I think as long as you're clear to separate your science from your interpretation, then there's nothing to be concerned about.
Cronin will work with scientists from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and three other universities on the State of Alaska-funded polar bear genetics project. He says they'll also be reviewing existing genetic data on sea lions and belugas, two other species whose decline has been linked to climate change and for which protective measures threaten development in Alaska. Today marks the winter solstice, the official first day of the season. Dark afternoons and blustery snowfalls sometimes bring groans even from hardy Alaskans, but Eagle River composer Kevin Barnett finds reason to rejoice in the chilly days at year's end, and his new CD, Elfenglow, is proof. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Imagine a cozy fire inside, bitter temperatures outside, and snowflakes drifting hypnotically past a windowpane. That's not hard to do when Kevin Barnett plays the various shadings of winter's moods on the keyboards. Alpenglow is the audio equivalent of pulling a comforter up to your chin on a sub-zero Alaska night.
It was our first snow of a year ago. It was on a Monday, and I came up with the melody. And when I played it for my wife when she came home, she said, "That reminds me when we used to live in New England when it was snowing out."
The Eagle River composer writes and produces most of his work from his home, perched in the foothills of the Chugach Mountains. He views those mountains from his living room. When the first dusting of snow sprinkles the high ridges, he knows his favorite time of year has arrived.
And then all of a sudden one day I was watching it snow on the top of a Highland Mountain across from our house, and then it finally hit me, the melody and what I needed to do.
Kevin Barnett knew he would make music his career in the fifth grade.
I was playing taps for the American Legion because I was playing trumpet at the time too. And when we were leaving the place, I was opening up the thank you card and I told my dad, "We need to turn around because about $35 fell out of the card." I said, "Dad, they accidentally left money in there." And he just laughed and said, "But Dad, you taught me how to be honest and they accidentally left money." And he said, "Kevin, you did a gig, you got paid to do the gig." I was like, "What is a gig?"
He grew up in Wisconsin. A musical father made sure he got piano lessons early on.
By the time I was around 6 years old, I started formal lessons. I always loved the piano. My dad and mom, if they had to discipline me, would always threaten taking lessons away, and I'd always freak out. So it wasn't threatening me to had to practice, it was taking the lessons away.
Barnett joined the Air Force to get into the Air Force band.
And I drove down to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and I had a 4.5-hour audition. And about 2 weeks later, I found myself the second oldest in basic training. And then it seemed like one day I woke up and I was retiring after 21 years. I got to play with a lot of phenomenal musicians around the world. We played for everything from grade school shows to kings and queens.
Now, 20-odd years later, Barnett and wife Gina are established Alaskans. They even have a husky dog named Kaya. Barnett works a bar gig solo at a popular Anchorage night spot, leads a church musical group, and performs casually with a trio that backs local singers. He teaches a few students but focuses on the arranging, producing, and recording end of the business at his own studio, Lovin' Dog Music. Again, he learned early about the business from a father who played in a symphony orchestra.
The most versatile musicians, say like the trumpet player in the symphony that was there at the time, ran the jazz studies program at the university, but he also played a polka gig one night, played in the symphony another night. So when I realized those were always the ones working in town, they may not have their name out front in lights or whatever, but they were the ones that were always had a gig, always playing somewhere. And I realized that's where it was at for me.
Barnett has a degree in jazz and classical piano and a master's in music technology. He's worked on movie scores and any number of theatrical productions and other people's CDs, not to mention writing the music for TV and radio advertisements.
It could be at the piano. It can be sometimes just having a cup of coffee. I write old school sometimes still with a staff paper and pencil and try to get away from cliches, away from the piano. And then other times I go right to the piano.
He finds inspiration for the winter theme all around him, even from Kaya, the dog.
I can remember when I was working on Dancing Huskies, Kaya many times will run out through her doggy door, go outside and play, and they come back excited, like, give me a treat. One day, I was working on the groove to Dancing Huskies, and she came up, started patting her paws on the lower end of the piano, similar rhythm to what I was kind of working on. I was like,
Alpenglow is Barnett's first solo effort, but some of Anchorage's best percussionists back him up on the album. Alpenglow has been well received outside Alaska and at home. Not surprising for a musician who is versatile enough to have played with the likes of Del Shannon, Lou Christie, and the Norman Luboff Choir. Alpenglow is available at local music stores, from CD Baby and through Barnett's website, lovin'dogmusic.com. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rosemarie Alexander and Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. And you can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.